Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from The Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. The Farm by Joy Williams. It was a dark night in August. Sarah and Tommy were going to their third party that night, the party where they would actually sit down to dinner. They were driving down Mixtuix Avenue, a long black avenue of trees that led out of the village, away from the shore and the coastal homes into the country. Tommy had been drinking only soda that night. Every other weekend, Tommy wouldn't drink. He did it, he said, to keep trim. He did it because he could. Sarah was telling a long story as she drove. She kept asking Tommy if she had told it to him before, but he was noncommittal. When Tommy didn't drink, Sarah talked and talked. She was telling him a terrible story that she had read in the newspaper about an alligator at a jungle farm attraction in Florida. The alligator had eaten a child who'd crawled into its pen. The alligator's name was Cookie. Its owner had shot it immediately. The owner was sad about everything. The child, the parent's grief, Cookie. He was quoted in the paper as saying that shooting Cookie was not an act of revenge. When Tommy didn't drink, Sarah felt cold. She was shivering in the car. There were goose pimples on her tanned, thin arms. Tommy sat beside her, smoking, saying nothing. There had been words between them earlier. The parties here had an undercurrent of sexuality. Sarah could almost hear it flowing around them all, carrying them all along. In the car on the night of the accident, Sarah was at the point in the evening when she felt guilty. She wanted to make things better, make things nice. She had gone through her elated stage, her jealous stage, her stubbornly resigned stage, and now she felt guilty. Had they talked about divorce that night, or had that been before, on other evenings? There was a flavor she remembered in their talks about divorce, a scent. It was hot, as Italy had been hot when they had been there. Dust, bread, sun, a burning at the back of the throat from too much drinking. They hadn't been talking about divorce that night. The parties had been crowded. Sarah had hardly seen Tommy. Then, on her way to the bathroom, she'd seen him sitting with a girl on a bed in one of the back rooms. He was telling the girl about condors, about hunting for condors in small, light plains. "Oh, but you didn't hurt them, did you?" the girl asked. She was someone's daughter, a little overweight, but with beautiful skin and large green eyes. "Oh, no," Tommy assured her. "We weren't hunting to hurt." Condors. Sarah looked at them sitting on the bed. When they noticed her, the girl blushed. Tommy smiled. Sarah imagined what she looked like standing in the doorway. She wished that they had shut the door. They had been at the Stedmans. The first party had been at the Perrys. The Perrys never served food. Sarah had had two or three drinks there. The bar had been set up beneath the grape arbor and everyone stood outside. It had still been light at the Perrys, but at the Stedmans it was dark and people drank inside. Everyone spoke about the end of summer as though it were a bewildering and unnatural event. They had stayed at the Stedmans longer than they should have, and they were going to be late for dinner. Nevertheless, they were driving at a moderate speed through a familiar landscape, passing houses that they had been entertained in many times. There were the Salts and the Hollands and the Grays and the Dodsons. The Dodsons kept their gin in the freezer and owned two large and dappled crotch-sniffing dogs. The Grays imported Southerners for their parties. The women all had lovely voices and knew how to make spoon bread and pickled tomatoes and artillery punch. The men had smiles when they'd say to Sarah, "Why, let me get you another. You don't have a thing in that glass, I swear." The Hollands gave the kind of dinner party where the shot was still in the duck and the silver should have been in a vault. Little whiskey was served, but there was always excellent wine. The Salts were a high-strung couple who often quarreled. Jenny Salt was on some type of medication for tension and often dropped the canapé she attempted to serve. Jenny and her husband Pete had a room in which there was nothing but a large dollhouse where witty mache figures carried on assignations beneath tiny clocks and crystal chandeliers. Once, when Sarah was examining the dollhouse's library where two figures were hunched over a chess game which was just about to be won, Pete had always said, on the 22nd move, Pete told Sarah that she had pretty eyes. She had moved away from him immediately. She had closed her eyes. In another room with the other guests, she had talked about the end of summer. On that night at the end of summer, the night of the accident, Sarah was still talking as they passed the Salts' house. She was talking about Venice. She and Tommy had been there once. They had drunk in the plaza and listened to the orchestras. Sarah quoted D.H. Lawrence on Venice. Abhorrent green and slippery city. But she and Tommy had liked Venice. They drank standing up at little bars. Sarah had had a cold and she drank grappa, and the cold had disappeared for the rest of her life. After the Salts house, the road swerved north and became very dark. There were no lights, no houses for several miles. There were stone walls, an orchard of sickly peach trees, a cider mill. There was St. James Episcopal Church, where Tommy took their daughter Martha to Sunday school. The Sunday school was highly fundamental. There were many arguments among the children and their teachers as to the correct interpretation of Bible story favorites. For example, when Lazarus rose from the dead, was he still sick? Martha liked the fervor at St. James. Each week her dinner graces were becoming more impassioned and fantastic. Martha was 7. Each Sunday, Tommy takes Martha to her little classes at St. James. Sarah can imagine the child sitting there at a low table with her jars of colors. Tommy doesn't go to church himself, and Martha's classes are 2 hours long. Sarah doesn't know where Tommy goes. She suspects he's seeing someone. When they come home on Sundays, Tommy is sleek, exhilarated. The three of them sit down to the dinner Sarah has prepared. Over the years, Sarah suspects, Tommy has floated to the surface of her. They are swimmers now, far apart on the top of the sea. Sarah at last fell silent. The road seemed endless, as in a dream. They seemed to be slowing down. She could not feel her foot on the accelerator. She could not feel her hands on the wheel. Her mind was an untidy cupboard filled with shining bottles. The road was dark and silvery and straight. In the space ahead of her, there seemed to be something. It beckoned, glittering. Sarah's mind cleared a little. She saw Martha with her hair cut oddly short. Sarah gently nibbled on the insides of her mouth to keep alert. She saw Tommy choosing a succession of houses, examining the plaster, the floorboards, the fireplaces, deciding where windows should be placed, walls knocked down. She saw herself taking curtains down from a window so that there would be a better view of the sea. The curtains knocked her glass from the sill, and it shattered. The sea was white and flat. It did not command her to change her life. It demanded of her nothing. She saw Martha sleeping, her paint-smudged fingers curled. She saw Tommy in the city with a woman riding in a cab. The woman wore a short fur jacket, and Tommy stroked it as he spoke. She saw a figure in the road ahead, its arms raised before its face as though to block out the sight of her. The figure was a boy who wore dark clothing, but his hair was bright. His face was shining. She saw her car leap forward and run him down where he stood. Tommy had taken responsibility for the accident. He had told the police he was driving. The boy apparently had been hitchhiking and had stepped out into the road. At the autopsy, traces of a hallucinogen were found in the boy's system. The boy was 15 years old and his name was Stevie Bentoncourt. No charges were filed. My wife, Tommy told the police, was not feeling well. My wife, Tommy said, was in the passenger seat. Sarah stopped drinking immediately after the accident. She felt nauseous much of the time. She slept poorly. Her hands hurt her. The bones in her hands ached. She remembered that this was the way she felt the last time she had stopped drinking. It had been 2 years before. She remembered why she had stopped, and she remembered why she had started again. She had stopped because she had done a cruel thing to her little Martha. It was spring, and she and Tommy were giving a dinner party. Sarah had 2 martinis in the late afternoon when she was preparing dinner, and then she had 2 more martinis with her guests. Martha had come downstairs to say a polite good night to everyone as she had been taught. She had put on her nightie and brushed her teeth. Sarah poured a little more gin in her glass and went upstairs with her to brush out her hair and put her to bed. Martha had long, thick blonde hair, of which she was very proud. On that night she wore it in a ponytail secured by an elasticized holder with 2 small colored balls on the end. Sarah's fingers were clumsy, and she could not get it off without pulling Martha's hair and making her cry. She got a pair of scissors and carefully began snipping at the stubborn elastic. The scissors were large, like shears, and they had been difficult to handle. A foot of Martha's gathered hair had abruptly fallen to the floor. Sarah remembered trying to pat it back into place on the child's head. So Sarah had stopped drinking the first time. She did not feel renewed. She felt exhausted and weary. She read and cooked. She realized how little she and Tommy had to talk about. Tommy drank scotch when he talked to her at night. Sometimes Sarah would silently count as he spoke to see how long the words took. When he was away and he telephoned her, she could hear the ice tinkling in the glass. She loved him. Tommy was in the city 4 days a week. He often changed hotels. He would bring Martha little bars of soap wrapped in the different colored papers of the hotels. Martha's drawers were full of the soap scenting her clothes. When Tommy came home on the weekends, he would work on the house, and they would give parties at which Tommy was charming. Tommy had a talent for holding his liquor and for buying old houses, restoring them, and selling them for 3 times what he had paid for them. Tommy and Sarah had moved 6 times in 11 years. All their homes had been fine old houses in excellent locations, 2 or 3 hours from New York. Sarah would stay in the country while Tommy worked in the city. Sarah did not know her way around New York. For 3 weeks, Sarah did not drink. Then it was her birthday. Tommy gave her a slim gold necklace and fastened it around her neck. He wanted her to come to New York with him, to have dinner, see a play, spend the night with him in the fine suite the company had given him at the hotel. They had got a babysitter for Martha, a marvelous woman who polished the silver in the afternoon when Martha napped. Sarah drove. Tommy had never cared for driving. His hand rested on her thigh. Occasionally he would slip his hand beneath her skirt. Sarah was sick with the thought that this was the way he touched other women. By the time they were in Manhattan, they were arguing. They had been married for 11 years. Both had had brief marriages before. They could argue about anything. In Midtown, Tommy stormed out of the car as Sarah braked for a light. He took his suitcase and disappeared. Sarah drove carefully for many blocks. When she had the opportunity, she would pull to the curb and ask someone how to get to Connecticut. No one seemed to know. Sarah thought she was probably phrasing the question poorly, but she didn't know how else to present it. After half an hour, she made her way back to the hotel where Tommy was staying. The doorman parked the car, and she went into the lobby. She looked into the hotel bar and saw Tommy in the dimness sitting at a small table. He jumped up and kissed her passionately. He rubbed his hands up and down her sides. "Darling, darling," he said, "I want you to have a happy birthday." Tommy ordered drinks for both of them. Sarah sipped hers slowly at first, but then she drank it and he ordered others. The bar was subdued. There was a piano player who sang about the Lord of the Dance. The words seemed like those of a hymn. The hymn made her sad, but she laughed. Tommy spoke to her urgently and gaily about little things. They laughed together like they had when they were first married. They had always drunk a lot together then and fallen asleep comfortably and lovingly entwined on white sheets. They went to their room to change for the theater. The maid had turned back the beds. There was a fresh rose and a bud vase on the writing desk. They had another drink in the room and got undressed. Sarah awoke the next morning curled up on the floor with the bedspread tangled around her. Her mouth was sore. There was a bruise on her leg. The television set was on with no sound. The room was a mess, although Sarah could see that nothing had been really damaged. She stared at the television set, where black-backed gulls were dive-bombing on terrified and doomed cygnets in a documentary about swans. Sarah crept into the bathroom and turned on the shower. She sat in the tub while the water beat upon her. Pinned to the outside of the shower curtain was a note from Tommy, who had gone to work. "Darling," the note said, "we had a good time on your birthday. I can't say I'm sorry we never got out. I'll call you for lunch. Love." Sarah turned the note inward until the water made the writing illegible. When the phone rang just before noon, she did not answer it. There's a certain type of conversation one hears only when one is drunk and is like a dream, full of humor and threat and significance, deep significance. And the way one witnesses things when one is drunk is different as well. It is like putting a face mask against the surface of the sea and looking into things into their baffled and guileless hearts. When Sarah had been a drinker, she felt that she had a fundamental and inventive grasp of situations, but now that she drank no longer, she found herself in the midst of a great and impenetrable silence which she could in no way interpret. It was a small village. Many of the people who lived there did not even own cars. The demands of the life were easily met in the village, and it was pretty there besides. It was divided between those who always lived there and who owned fishing boats and restaurants, and the city people who had more recently discovered the area as a summer place and winter weekend investment. On the weekends, the New Yorkers would come up with their house guests and their pâté and cheeses and build fires and go cross-country skiing. Tommy came home to Sarah on weekends. They did things together. They agreed on where to go. During the week, she was on her own. Once, alone, she saw a helicopter carrying a tree in a sling across the sound. The wealthy could afford to leave nothing behind. Once, with the rest of the town, she saw 5 boats burning in their storage shrouds. Each summer resort has its winter pyromaniac. Sarah did not read any more. Her eyes hurt when she read, and her hands ached all the time. During the week, she marketed and walked and cared for Martha. It was 3 months after Steve Bentoncourt was killed when his mother visited Sarah. She came to the door and knocked on it, and Sarah let her in. Genevieve Bentoncourt was a woman Sarah's age, although she looked rather younger. She had been divorced almost from the day that Stevie was born. She had another son named Bruce who lived with his father in Nova Scotia. She had an old powder blue Buick parked on the street before Sarah's house. The Buick had one white door. The two women sat in Sarah's handsome, sunny living room. It was very calm, very peculiar, almost thrilling. Genevieve looked all around the room. Off the living room were the bedrooms. The door to Sarah's and Tommy's was closed, but Martha's door was open. She had a little hanging garden against the window. She had a hamster in a cage. She had an enormous bookcase filled with dolls and books. Genevieve said to Sarah, "That room wasn't there before. This used to be a lobster pound. I know a great deal about this town. People like you have nothing to do with what I know about this town. Do you remember the way things were ever?" "No," Sarah said. Genevieve sighed. "Does your daughter look like you or your husband?" "No one's ever told me she looked like me," Sarah said quietly. On the glass-topped table before them, there was a little wooden sculpture cutout that Tommy had bought. A man and woman sat on a park bench. Each wore a startled and ambiguous expression. Each had a terrier on the end of a string. The dogs were a puzzle. One fit on top of the other. Sarah was embarrassed about it being there. Tommy had put it on the table during the weekend, and Sarah hadn't moved it. Genevieve didn't touch it. "I did not want my life to know you," Genevieve said. She removed a hair from the front of her white blouse and dropped it to the floor. She looked out the window at the sun. The floor was of a very light and varnished pine. Sarah could see the hair upon it. "I'm so sorry," Sarah said. "I'm so very, very sorry." She stretched her neck and put her head back. She looked as though she were choking. "Stevie was a mixed-up boy," Genevieve said. "They threw him off the basketball team. He took pills. He had bad friends. He didn't study, and he got a D in geometry, and they wouldn't let him play basketball." She got up and wandered around the room. She wore green rubber boots, dirty jeans, and a beautiful hand-knit sweater. "I once bought all my fish here," she said. "The O'Malleys owned it. There were practically no windows, just narrow high ones over the tanks. Now it's all windows, isn't it? Don't you feel exposed?" "No, I," Sarah began. "There are drapes," she said. "Off to the side, where you have your garden, there are whale bones if you dig deep enough. I can tell you a lot about this town." "My husband wants to move," Sarah said. "I can understand that, but you're the real drinker, after all, aren't you? Not him." "I don't drink any more," Sarah said. She looked at the woman dizzily. Genevieve was not pretty, but she had a clear, strong face. She sat down on the opposite side of the room. "I guess I would like something," she said. "A glass of water." Sarah went to the kitchen and poured a glass of Vichy for them both. Her hands shook. "We are not strangers to one another," Genevieve said. "We could be friends." "My first husband always wanted to be friends with my second husband," Sarah said after a moment. "I could never understand it." This had somehow seemed analogous when she was saying it, but now it did not. "It is not appropriate that we be friends," she said. Genevieve continued to sit and talk. Sarah found herself concentrating desperately on her articulate, one-sided conversation. She suspected that the words Genevieve was using were codes for other words, terrible words. Genevieve spoke thoughtlessly, dispassionately, with erratic flourishes of language. Sarah couldn't believe that they were chatting about food, men, the red clouds massed above the sea. "I have a friend who is a designer," Genevieve said. "She hopes to make a great deal of money some day. Her work has completely altered her perceptions. Every time she looks at a view, she thinks of sheets. Take out those mountains, she will say. Lighten that cloud a bit, and it would make a great sheet. When she looks at the sky, she thinks of lingerie. Now, when I look at the sky, I think of earlier times, happier times when I looked at the sky. I have never been in love, have you?" Yes, Sarah said, I'm in love. It's not a lucky thing, you know, to be in love. There was a soft scuffling at the door and Martha came in. Hello, she said. School was good today. I'm hungry. Hello, dear, Genevieve said. To Sarah, she said, perhaps we can have lunch sometime. Who is that? Martha asked Sarah after Genevieve had left. A neighbor, Sarah said, one of Mommy's friends. When Sarah told Tommy about Genevieve coming to visit her, he said, it's harassment. It can be stopped. It was Sunday morning. They had just finished breakfast, and Tommy and Martha were drying the silver and putting it away. Martha was wearing her church school clothes, and she was singing a song she had learned the Sunday before. I'm going to the mansion on the Happy Days Express, she sang. Tommy squeezed Martha's shoulders. Go get your coat, sweetie, he said. When the child had gone, he said to Sarah, don't speak to this woman. Don't allow it to happen again. We didn't talk about that. What else could you talk about? It's weird. No one talks about that. No one ever. Tommy was wearing a corduroy suit and a tie Sarah had never seen before. Sarah looked at the pattern in the tie. It was random and bright. Are you having an affair? Sarah asked. No, he said easily. I don't understand you, Sarah. I've done everything I could to protect you, to help you straighten yourself out. It was a terrible thing, but it's over. You have to get over it. Now, just don't see her again. There's no way that she can cause trouble if you don't speak to her. Sarah stopped looking at Tommy's tie. She moved her eyes to the potato she had peeled and put in a bowl of water. Martha came into the kitchen and held onto her father's leg. Her hair was long and thick, but it was getting darker. It was as though it had never been cut. After they left, Sarah put the roast in the oven and went into the living room. The large window was full of the day, a colorless, windy day without birds. Sarah sat on the floor and ran her fingers across the smooth, varnished wood. Beneath the expensive flooring was cold cement. Tanks had once lined the walls. Lobsters had crept back and forth across the mossy glass. The phone rang. Sarah didn't look at it, suspecting it was Genevieve. Then she picked it up. Hello, said Genevieve. I thought I might drop by. It's a bleak day, isn't it? Cold. Is your family at home? They go out on Sunday, Sarah said. It gives me time to think. They go to church. What do you think about? The woman's voice seemed far away. Sarah strained to hear her. I'm supposed to cook dinner. When they come back, we eat dinner. I can prepare clams in 43 different ways, Genevieve said. This is a roast pork. Well, may I come over? All right, Sarah said. She continued to sit on the floor, waiting for Genevieve, looking at the water beneath the sky. The water on the horizon was a wide satin ribbon. She wished that she had the courage to swim on such a bitter winter day, to swim far out and rest, to hesitate and then to return. Her life was dark, unexplored. Her abstinence had drained her. She felt sluggish, robbed. Her body had no freedom. She sat, seeing nothing, the terrible calm light of the day around her. The things she remembered were so far away, bathed in a different light. Her light seemed so remote to her. She had sought happiness in someone, knowing she could not find it in herself, and now her heart was strangely hard. She rubbed her head with her hands. Her life with Tommy was broken, irreparable. Her life with him was over. His infidelities kept getting mixed up in her mind with the death of the boy, with Tommy's false admission that he had been driving when the boy died. Sarah couldn't understand anything. Her life seemed so random, so needlessly constructed, and now threatened in a way which did not interest her. Hello, Genevieve called. She had opened the front door and was standing in the hall. You didn't hear my knock. Sarah got up. She was to entertain this woman. She felt anxious, adulterous. The cold rose from Genevieve's skin and hair. Sarah took her coat and hung it in the closet. The fresh, cold smell lingered on her hands. She found herself staring at her hands as though they were predatory animals. Sarah moved into the kitchen. She took a package of rolls out of the freezer. "Does your little girl like church?" Genevieve asked. "Yes, very much." "It's a stage," said Genevieve. "I'm Catholic myself. As a child, I used to be fascinated by the martyrs. I remember a picture of St. Lucy carrying her eyes like a plate of eggs, and St. Agatha, she carried her breasts on a plate." Sarah said, "I don't understand what we're talking about. I know you're just using these words, that they mean other words. Perhaps we could take your little girl to a movie sometime, a matinee after she gets out of school." Her name is Martha, Sarah said. She saw Martha grown up, her hair cut short once more, taking rolls out of the freezer, waiting. Martha, yes, Genevieve said. Have you wanted more children? No, Sarah said. Their conversation was illegal, unspeakable. Sarah couldn't imagine it ever ending. Her fingers tapped against the ice cube trays. Would you care for a drink? A very tall glass of vermouth, Genevieve said. She was looking at a little picture Martha had made that Sarah had tacked to the wall. It was a very badly drawn horse. I wanted children. I wanted to fulfill myself. One can never fulfill oneself. I think it's an impossibility. Sarah made Genevieve's drink very slowly. She did not make one for herself. When Stevie was Martha's age, he knew everything about whales. He kept notebooks. Once on his birthday, I took him to the Whaling Museum in New Bedford. She sipped her drink. It all goes wrong somewhere, she said. She turned her back on Sarah and went into the other room. Sarah followed her. There are so many phrases for dead, you know, Genevieve was saying. The kids think them up, or they come out of wars. There was one Stevie would use for dead animals and rock stars. He said they'd bought the farm. Sarah nodded. She was pulling and peeling at the nails of her hands. I think it's pretty creepy. A dark farm, you know. Weedy, run down, broken machinery everywhere. A real job. Sarah raised her head. You want us to share Martha, don't you? She said. It's only right, isn't it? The paint blown away, acres and acres of tangled black land, a broken shutter over the well. Sarah lowered her head again. Her heart was cold, horrified. The reality of these two women, placed by hazard in this room, this bright, functional, tasteful room that Tommy had created, was being tested. Reality would resist for days, perhaps weeks, but then it would yield. It would yield to this guest, this visitor for whom Sarah had made room. "Would you join me in another drink?" Genevieve asked. "Then I'll go." "I mustn't drink," Sarah said. "You don't forget," Genevieve said. "That's just an old saw." She went into the kitchen and poured more vermouth for herself. Sarah could smell the meat cooking. From another room, the clock chimed. "You must come to my home soon," Genevieve said. She did not sit down. Sarah looked at the pale green liquid in the glass. "Yes," Sarah said. "Soon. We must not greet one another on the street, however. People are quick to gossip." "Yes," Sarah said, "they would condemn us." She looked heavily at Genevieve, full of misery and submission. There was knocking on the door. "Sarah!" Tommy's voice called. "Why is the door locked?" She could see his dark head at the window. "I must have thrown the bolt," Genevieve said. "It's best to lock your house in winter, you know. It's the kids, mostly. They get bored. Stevie was a robber once or twice, I'm sure." She put down her glass, took her coat from the closet, and went out. Sarah heard Martha say, "That's Mommy's friend." Tommy stood in the doorway and stared at Sarah. "Why did you lock the door?" he asked again. Sarah imagined seeing herself naked. She said, "There are robbers." Tommy said, "If you don't feel safe here, we'll move. I've been looking at a wonderful place about 20 miles from here, on a cove. It only needs a little work. It will give us more room. There's a barn, some fence. Martha could have a horse." Sarah looked at him with an intent, halted expression, as though she were listening to a dialogue no one present was engaged in. Finally, she said, "There are robbers. Everything has changed." And that story was The Farm by Joy Williams from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sunsound of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is also from the Treasury of American Short Stories. Happy Families by A.C. Hoffman. If Mama hadn't been so afraid of sex. Brother and sister sit companionably eating chocolates and playing their favorite game. It is seldom now that they find moments to be together. The long afternoons of childhood which they shared have retreated into memory. A flickering image of the ornately patterned rug startles Maud once in a while as she's falling asleep. But why does she remember only part of the pattern? Hal is sitting on the other part absorbed in a game of jacks, his nimble fingers controlling the game, dropping and catching the small rubber ball, humming the score to himself. But even as she asks herself the question, the pattern vanishes and she falls into deeper sleep, shaken by more terrible images and voices than that faded pattern in grandmother's living room rug. If her brother Hal dreams, and certainly he has never confessed this to Maud. His dreams are probably filled with all the things they missed as children. Cousins whose arrival was imminent but who never appeared to play with them. Family unavoidably detained by disasters of catastrophic proportions while on their way to the house. He can still taste on his tongue the contents of those enormous boxes of chocolates which Aunt Constance would bring on her infrequent visits. Chocolates wrapped in gold and silver paper and filled with whole nuts and cherries, floating in pink syrup that ran down his chin and lay in heavy blots on his shirt. Aunt Constance appeared and disappeared, a happy phantom tripping down the stairs on the way to supper as if she were their younger sister and not their father's. Constance's name appears next to their father's on the family tree, and below the name the dates of her birth and death. She had been very young when she died, and no one in the family talks about her. Hal, turning over in sleep, tastes over and over again those fat chocolates filled with syrup and cherries. He is no longer sure if he knows Constance among the faces in the photographs that crowd the shelves in the cabinet, but he has never forgotten the boxes tied in wide red ribbon that she would bring the children. The chocolates he shares with Maud now are poor counterfeits for the real thing. If Mama had known more about sex, would we be here? They beam affectionately at each other, looking out over the garden and lawn. Like everything in their grandmother's house, it is now unkempt but charming. The trees planted when the house was newly built have grown and now overshadow the house and lawn. The perennials in the garden have long ago spread, riotously fighting each other for precious space. The phlox and daisies have reverted back to their original bloodline. The roses unpruned have grown into thickets across the wall. But the peonies bravely bloom, their heads heavy and succulent. Old-fashioned colors, Maud's friends tell her, but she will not touch the 100-year roots. Whoever buys a house when I'm gone can worry about that. I won't separate the peony roots. She brings the blooms into the house, filling the vases. Even as she and Hal talk, the heavy flowers shed slowly and quietly over the magazines and books that sprawl across the library table. A studio portrait of their parents gazes discreetly at the littered table. If there are any secrets, they never shared them with their children. Mama sits, her eyes enormous, in a peaked face. Father has placed his hand heavily on her shoulder as if he's supporting himself. He is considerably older, his face lined, the eyes tired. Both of them seem to be leaning forward to have achieved a precarious balance, attempting to keep their distance from the urns and palms the photographer has arranged behind them. Gazing now at the photograph, Maud realizes that it has slipped in the frame and is hanging crooked. "Let's straighten out Mom and Papa," she says to Hal, and they laugh uproariously. They have begun to drink the sherry now, and it is beginning to affect them. Hal strides over to deal with the frame while Maud pours more wine into Grandma's ruby glasses and nibbles on another biscuit from the tin. Probably Papa taught her. He had much more experience. The endless mystery of procreation. As children, they stood in awe of that massive bed with brass columns joining together to create a temple pediment larger at the head than at the foot, not unlike the ornate iron fencing that enclosed the family plot at Briarwood. Maud was fond of visiting cemeteries for no other reason than she found them pleasant gardens in which to stroll looking at the epitaphs. She had learned to read by walking among the gravestones with grandmother, a woman dressed completely in black. She was eternally in mourning for someone, family or friends or neighbors. It made no difference to her. And she enjoyed their afternoons in the cemetery, raising her parasol against the sun and strolling with Maud, her long skirts wavering across the granite curbstones. She had trouble bending, her girth was enormous, and so Maud would spell out the letters for her in a bright, prattling voice. C-R-A. I don't know the next letter, Grandmother. Go on, don't stop. Skip the ones you don't know. F-O-I-D. You got another one wrong. You forfeit. She rocked back and forth on her heels. The Crawfords. I should have remembered they were stuck back here, the back of beyond. Bucky Crawford thought he was getting a bargain. Like all the Crawfords, he was crass. Your grandpa kept pointing out that this section would never attract the best families, and as always, grandpa was right. Though conceited as he was, I would never tell him so. Now, child, here's a sweet. You did very well. Grandmother pulls a sticky lemon drop out of her pocket, fuzzy with lint but tasting the more exotic for it. Oh, bliss, sucking on a lemon drop, hopping on and off the graves, reading the names and dates for grandmother, who strides purposefully toward the family plot, surrounded by an ornate fence, stamped in iron with a weeping willow and a woolly sheep alternating around the square. I told him don't waste money on a real fence. Said, Richard, you want to give pride to the relatives looking in. They want to feel that we belong here, make our mark in the world. What counts is what people see. Why should the dead care what's on their side? So Grandpa had bargained for a stamped iron enclosure with a real gate. There was a latch that opened and shut the mourner inside with the dead. Grandmother enjoyed standing at some distance away so that she could enjoy the view of the enclosure. In the bright sunlight, the fence looked handsome and substantial. Grandmother was right. Walking around it, Maud felt impressed belonging to the family buried there. Stumbling over the small gravestones embedded in the ground at odd angles around the family plot, she felt a confidence and security much like going to sleep in her mother's massive bed after Mama and Papa were dead, and she took the room for herself. The dead looking out at the world did not care if the stamped iron is hollow and unprepossessing on their side of the wall. They sleep in solitude, in silence, and they do not hear the faint footsteps walking over them spelling out their names. C-O-N. I can't make out this name, Grandmother. T-A. Never mind, Maud. Home now. I've had enough walking for one day. Close the gate tight. Don't want dogs fouling the ground in there. Shoo! Shoo! She's waving her parasol toward a bush where a dog may or may not be fouling the graves. Grandmother was always good at changing the subject. Where did I come from, Grandmother? God, she said firmly, and the subject was closed. Well, there never was a breath of scandal attached to them. The only untypical gesture was that their parents owned an open touring car at a time when everyone else bragged about the snugness of riding in a closed automobile. You could take a drive in all kinds of weather without first having to check the barometer to see if it was rising or falling. Papa liked the feeling of being able to look out and practically touch the scenery, and besides, if the thunder rumbled and the rain threatened, the car's occupants could always get out and earn their keep by putting up the isinglass panels. But that hardly ever happened to them. Sunny weather on their expeditions, always. Mama raised her eyebrows and pretended to be inspecting the sleeve of her jacket for lint. It was better to acquiesce to Papa's weaknesses. His vices were an open book. Where Hal got his wildness was anybody's guess. Looking at the family tree gave no clue except for the empty spaces under Aunt Constance and their names, which suggested that it might still be possible that they would each send out new growth. But Constance had died young, never marrying, though she had plenty of offers, being a pretty, popular girl, well-liked, but never wild like some of her contemporaries. Maud had even been engaged once. The details are blurred in her head now. It is best to erase heartbreak by saying it had never happened. Her only memento was a trip with Hal to Europe to forget it all, but Hal was no solace, particularly since he disappeared into the ship's bar even before the ship sailed, leaving her alone in the cabin to go over and over again the steps by which she tricked herself into believing that she really and truly wanted to get married and go to bed with the man and bear his children. She still chokes at the thought of her escape, though at the time she had no way of knowing that the heavy weight on her heart was not grief, but guilt over what she had almost done to herself and the hapless young man who had asked her to marry him. She slept at ease in her parents' marriage bed, untroubled by the ghosts of unborn children or the energy, passionate or passive, from which she and Hal were conceived. There were two grandmothers. That had been confusing to the children, particularly Maud. The tall, grim figure who walked the cemetery lanes with Maud is suddenly replaced by a different grandmother who belonged to Mama and who arrived to keep the children company while the will was probated and the estate divided. Poor Papa was not his father's son when it came to making wills and disposing of property. Grandmother would have turned spiteful and called him a Crawford, but as she herself pointed out, the dead did not look at the back of a stamped iron fence, and she could not comment on her son's ineptness while on her back 4 feet under, having been thriftily buried on top of Grandpapa so as to leave more room in the plot for the rest of them. The other grandmother was a slight figure in her dotage when the children knew her. She wore black satin slippers on her swollen feet, tottering about and whispering. Her deafness was crushing, and she had no way of gauging the loudness of her voice. In her other life, when she was the bustling, happy mother of many children, she had always been meticulously groomed, smart from head to toe, forever bending down to pick up minute particles from the polished floors, to brush the reluctant shoulders of her husband and children already through the door when she calls them back for a final brushing. "I want you to look your best." Her smile was warm and friendly. And who could grow angry when she finished the inspection with a quick hug and wet kiss on a departing cheek? But by the time she moved into her daughter's house to supervise the orphan children, she had given up wearing stays, and soon gave up wearing her dentures, which had always been a torment. Her husband had grudgingly paid the bill, claiming that the dentist overcharged. He had never heard of such foolishness. They did not fit well, but she said nothing, enduring until the night she removed them for the last time and deliberately dropped them into the marble sink where they broke into many pieces. She kept tins of pound cake under her bed, gifts from the other children who seldom visited. This was not a misfortune, since her memory, never very strong, began to slacken, and there were days when she thought Maud and Hal were her two youngest children, still in the nursery and needing great care and devotion after a lengthy bout of scarlet fever. She exerted great pressure to keep them in the house, consuming hot soup and nourishing custards. "I must fatten you two," she poked Hal in the ribs. "You need more fat there. Can't have you sick again." School was still in term. The weather had turned sulky, moving out of February into March, days of cold, drizzly rain which turned the garden into a sea of mud followed by frost and heavy snow. The children discovered a bound set of National Geographic. Nothing was discarded in either of the two families. The name of the owner on the bookplate was unknown to them, and it was never clear who had possessed and relinquished such a treasure. Contentedly, they put away their school books. They were repeating a great deal of work that year because of a change in headmasters, and both of them were thoroughly bored. There was nothing more refreshing, they discovered, than to sit cozily in the living room, feet tucked on the fireplace fender, thermostat turned high, and heat roaring around the corners of the room, reading about the Orinoco and consuming another creamy custard Grandma had brought fresh from the oven on an old tray advertising a soft drink that they had never tasted, and whose name sounded just as foreign as the tributaries of the Amazon. Later, when Grandma decided that they had recovered from their illness, she would come down, dreamily carrying a tin of pound cake to share a slice with Maud or Hal, staring at her end and picking off tiny pieces with trembling fingers, always surprised that the child at the other end was as voracious and quick-fingered as she, both nibbling the cake like small animals. Maud and Hal were Papa's children by a second marriage. He had children from that first marriage, but they were enigmas to them, names on the family tree to which twigs were attached, bearing more names. There were also cousins who belonged to both sides of the family, but they seldom saw them, and whenever one was sent to visit them, the afternoon was an occasion. The cousins were never very interesting, the girls eager to show Maud that her tea set was not as expensive or extensive as theirs, that her dolls did not wet their diapers while crying Mama. They were not interested in the bound set of the magazines, nor in walking the garden to catch toads after a rainstorm. Hal had less trouble with guests since he and the boys could run races up and down the long staircase, trying to push each other down a flight so as to race ahead. Grandma's deafness was considered a great asset by the boys, who could tear away to their heart's content, stopping red-faced only when she came out of her room to ask, "Would you like a bracing cup of cocoa?" and then herding them before her on the descent to the kitchen, where sheepishly they would help her find the tin of cocoa and the sugar bowl, pour the milk into the saucepan for her, strike the match to pop the gas ring. She kept them busy working around her, and when the steaming cups were set before them, she said, laughing like a mischievous child, "I have the loveliest surprise," and floated in each cup a huge dollop of whipped cream that refused to sink, and through which they drank the cocoa, a sticky white rime forming around the lips which they licked for a long time after the cup was drained and the games on the stairs resumed. Once Maud and Hal had been sent down to play with a yellow-faced boy whose name they had forgotten, but who suggested to Hal that they undress Maud so that he could show him something. After Maud fled in tears to Grandma, who assumed it was some rough boy's game and comforted her with a tiny piece of pound cake and a game of dominoes, the boys took down their pants and inspected each other critically. But that boy had never returned, nor did they ever glimpse him at the occasional family gathering to which they put in an appearance. They never learned who he was or how he was related to them. Hal had enjoyed the time spent with him, learning once and for all that he was different from Maud, whom he had surreptitiously observed taking a bath, having learned how to construct a periscope from the encyclopedia and poking it up the open transom of the bathroom. He worried that he was different from Maud because there was something wrong with him. In the hazy days before they both came down with scarlet fever, he may or may not have been a boy, and the visit and inspection were comforting, and the true start of his career as a young man about town who loved them possessively and dearly, but who also left them quickly when they responded and began to make demands of him. "Oh, Hal," Maud wept, "I don't know why you are so cruel to Cora." Cora had only just departed, wrung in tears and full of hot tea and sticky buns. The confidences lay heavy on Maud's shoulders, which even then were beginning to slope so that Grandma, despite her opposition to stays, decreed that she should be measured for a surgical brace to keep her posture under control. Maud inadvertently caught the bride's bouquet, which Cora threw spitefully toward the two of them as she stood on the staircase radiant and submissively leaning against her beaming groom. Hal had ducked, realizing what Cora meant to do, but Maud put her arms up to stop the projectile and became the center of much banter and laughter for catching the bride's bouquet. The family tree was intricate, filled with many lateral branches. They were part of a large enterprise. A fourth cousin spent years compiling it and proudly arrived with a framed copy for them to inspect and hang over the mantel in place of the grim-visaged ancestral photographs that had occupied the space. Cousin Beth pulled the library steps close to the gaping mouth of the fireplace and handed the framed photographs to the children, who put them face down on the floor. Proudly she pointed out their names to them. There was just a little space below their names. It was as if the cousin knew instinctively that this branch of the tree was going to stop growing. Lying on the rug, Maud would squint her eyes and look up at the tree hanging above her. "You'll ruin your eyes, my dear. Grandma worries ineffectually about their teeth, their hearts, their livers, their digestions. She has a small hoard of bottles in the bathroom cabinet. No pills are thrown away even after the malady has disappeared. No drops poured down the sink. Her memory is unclear about the illness and remedy prescribed, but medicine paid for is medicine to be used. She doses Maud and Hal, sweetening the dose with a peppermint. Like the other grandmother, she believes strongly in the efficacy of camphor to ward off infection, castor oil for constipation, and honey and lemon for coughs. Despite all her doctoring, Maud and Hal survive." Maud and Hal, in dim euphoria, play their weekly game of dominoes. Grandma taught them, and Hal spent many happy afternoons playing with Grandma and concentrating on how to cheat. This had always proved impossible since Grandma herself cheated, and besides, she had altered the rules to suit her style of play without telling the children when she taught them the game. Over the years, each player has developed a strategy so that if one of them wins this Friday, the other will inevitably take the game the next time they meet. "Do you remember our other grandmother?" Hal asks. "A little." Maud is trying to hold off his attack, and even though it is his time to win, she will not give him an easy victory. "That was her picture, wasn't it, that used to hang over the mantel?" Maud looks puzzled, staring at the family tree. "Cousin Beth took them down to put up the tree," he says. "Right, now I remember. I think those photographs are still up in the attic. We ought to go up there sometime and look at them." "Where would you put them?" Hal lives in a pokey apartment, oppressively crowded with his share of the massive furniture that looks sparse in this enormous old house. "I didn't say I wanted them. I just wondered about them. Put names to faces is all I meant." "Oh," Maud concentrates, willing him to turn around to go to the tray for more sherry. She is working out a possible trick to defeat him, but it will mean some extra maneuvering. "I know what you're going to try," Hal warns. "What?" "Even if you pull it off, which I don't think you will, because I'm watching you, you still won't be able to win the game." "Damn," says Maud, foiled again. "Goodbye, love," Hal leans over and brushes her cheek. Tears spring from behind her eyelids. "He will return next week. He comes every Friday to visit her. The two of them can never admit that there is no one else who cares for them. Hal's girls seem to grow younger with the years. Each year a new one, though now they arrive and depart more quickly, some only lasting a month. Hal's practiced lechery is contracting into smaller time spans, and he's already undressing the girl even as he makes his first cool advance. There's so little time, and gratification comes harder. Maud looks at his thickening body, the face drawn and pouchy. She turns away in alarm. This is a trick her failing eyes are playing on her. She must stop being vain and begin to wear her glasses. Oh, she's so weary of trying to move gracefully, to ignore the crepey skin under her chin, the bulging muscles covered by slack skin on her arms. An athletic Hal smiles at her from the corner of the room, looking over the net, a tennis racket swinging nonchalantly from his hand. It had been fun to play together, the ball rhythmically dropping first on one side of the net and then the other. They could volley for minutes at a time, the ball imperceptibly creeping closer to the top of the net until, touching the court, it drops abruptly at Maud's feet. "Oh, Hal, you dog, you planned that shot on purpose." Hal modestly disclaims any expertise. "Come on, Maud, your serve. Stop grousing." She slams a serve accurately into the corner. No matter how quickly he runs, how swiftly he lifts the racket to return, the ball puffs the chalk and bounces away from him. With Hal's departure, the light in the garden extinguishes and the night shadows crawl the wall as she prepares for bed. No need for supper. The biscuits nibbled with the sherry have filled her. How can her body expand when she feeds it reluctantly and erratically? She has inherited the family corpulence. Hal, seen from behind, is still slim. Before he turns his ravished face, he might be a young man in flannels chasing tennis balls. Her stocky frame has always promised that her figure would be full, the breasts voluptuous, the abdomen protruding like a woman in the first stages of pregnancy. She turns on few lights. She has lived in this house a long time, knowing all the creaks on the staircase as she climbs toward bed. She gropes toward the door which leads to her parents' room. Mama's a soft, breathy voice in the dark, a faint presence who has no substance in her memory. Maud looks, as she does every night, at her mother's face, a beautiful woman if her photograph is trusted. In the dimness surrounding the table beside the bed, she maintains her neutrality. Before Maud switches off the light and gropes her way in the soft darkness toward the bed, she tries to recall both of them, the small-boned woman and the graying, corpulent man. But before her eyes, there's only a void into which she prepares to fall, exhausted and spent. "Oh," Maud laughs softly, stepping on the family tree laid out like a rug, and suddenly, underfoot, the mysterious pattern that haunts her dreams is made visible. This is a section of the family tree which contains the names of her grandparents, their daughter Constance, her father, and his two wives. Over in the right-hand corner, barely discernible, are their names. Nothing stems from them. The rug ends there. "Hal, don't you want to have children?" Unwillingly, she remembers Kathy's bloated face looking down at Hal on that long-ago picnic. "I can't give you anything but love," her rough, awkward voice entreats, and Hal looks up and says, "Pass the pickles, Maud." No one asks, "Why didn't you have children, Maud?" Competent, efficient, sarcastic, witty Maud, self-contained and self-centered, having solved once more the mystery of that pattern, submerges like a diver gliding through the smoky water towards a clear light at the bottom of the sea. And she dreams, as always, of holding a sleeping child hard against her budding breasts. After the accident, the terrified onlookers pulled the children from the crackling wreck and sat them by the side of the road. Maud, blood running from a cut over her ear, cradles a sobbing Hal to sleep so that he does not hear the ambulance arrive or see the stretcher crew take away their bloody and mangled booty. In every happy family, there are such moments when two lives are irrevocably entwined, and the family tree ends with their names placed side by side, as if already planted in the spaces allotted to them in the family plot. And that story was Happy Families by A.C. Hoffman from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. The Things Impossible by Bruce Bennett. Perhaps a single feature of the villanelle that 20th century poets made their own is the absence of narrative possibility. The form refuses to tell a story. That's from The Making of a Poem. Don't write a villanelle to tell a tale. They're not the form for narrative or plot. It's pretty obvious why you will fail. For instance, there's an island, you set sail. The wind is perfect and the day is hot. Don't write a villanelle to tell a tale. Because, well, you will have to see a whale, a wonder, but it can't be caught or shot. You see, it's obvious why you will fail. Say you're with her and you're both at the rail. I don't think I've mentioned it's a yacht. Don't write a villanelle to tell a tale. A magic moment you'll embrace. The ale your steward brought will just have hit the spot. But wait, it should be obvious you'll fail. Since now her husband, who's been sprung from jail, is in that sloop approaching, and he's got. Don't write a villanelle to tell a tale. The thing's impossible, you're bound to fail. And that was The Thing's Impossible by Bruce Bennett from Pushcart Prize, Volume 37 from the year 2013, edited by Bill Henderson. And that's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.